The journey to the north was something that had been the idea had been hatched a couple of years ago, and so I thought I might it was like a kind of epic journey, so I thought I might talk a little bit about that this evening. Also, I do apologize that I'm not quite in this time zone yet. It's about 4:45 in the morning in England, so I occasionally slide off into a kind of dozy patch, you know. Please forgive me. Over the last few months, as people heard that both for Ajahn Sumedho and myself and the others of us who are planning to go on this trip, you know, first of all people would say, oh, going off to the Arctic, oh, that's interesting, and then they would inevitably ask, why? You know, why are you going to the far north? So it's a fair enough question. The place that we went to is a collection of islands called Svalbard. The main island of the group is called Spitsbergen, about 600 miles from the North Pole, up at the 80th parallel, that sort of area. And the Arctic Circle is between the 66th and the 67th parallel, just to give you a bit of a bearing. So people ask, why on earth do you want to go all the way up there? Is there a retreat happening? Or is there a monastery there? Or it was a strange sort of collection of circumstances that really initiated the journey. And it started in many ways about 27, 28 years ago, when Ajahn Sumedho was first in England in 1977, having left Thailand and been invited to start up a branch monastery in London. He and three other monks settled in a small house in Hampstead in London. And during that time, Ajahn Sumedho had been over 10 years in Thailand and was very fond of the forest monastic life, and suddenly, not through any wish or plan of his own, he was invited to go to England, and Ajahn Chah had acquiesced to the starting of this new branch monastery. And during these early months that Ajahn Sumedho was there, he had a series of three different visions, nimitta, in his in meditation practice. They were all quite different from each other. And the second one of these was an image, a very powerful image, and a strong emotional, with a strong emotional tone of being alone, naked in the Arctic wilderness, freezing cold, in the dim twilight, the howling wind and the sound of the wolves in the air howling nearby, and these utterly sort of bitter and uninviting external conditions, everything that you wouldn't want, everything that was kind of threatening and painful, difficult, that would arouse despair or anguish, but yet it was extraordinarily peaceful. So everything that would have suggested a miserable and anguished state was in fact there was a kind of blissful peace that accompanied that state. And this was he said that, you know, that there was this vision was there for that particular period of meditation, but the mood, the tone that brought with it stayed with him for a long time. And also, strangely enough, a couple of weeks after he had this vision, a Laplander showed up at the Hampstead Vihara, the little monastery in London where they were living. And I don't know how many of us have ever met any Laplanders. You know, it's not very common that one runs into one of the Sami people, but one actually showed up at the Vihara in London shortly after this. So this was obviously some way of underscoring the significance of that vision. And what it said when he investigated it, what it said to Ajahn Sumedho was became a very key insight for his whole time in Britain, because in Thailand there's a very strong ethic of I don't want to bother with engaging with people. I want to get back to my kuti, my hut, and meditate. I want to retreat to the forest, be alone, get on with the formal practice, and to disengage, to not be, even when you're in the monastery, to not be chatting with other people, not be engaged in excessive activity, but to get back to your kuti, to be alone, to seek solitude. And this is obviously a very significant and useful ethic, and it's very much part of our lives in the forest monastic tradition. But what this insight or this experience led Ajahn Sumedho to was a sense of that no matter how difficult or testing painful the external conditions were, that actually the internal quality of peace was independent of those circumstances. And what his reflections led him to was the recognition that if I live here in England wanting to be left alone to meditate in the forest, I'm a fool, because it's not going to happen. We're a new religion in this country. We've been invited here. We're living in London for a start, and also, I have a reputation as a teacher. People want me to teach, and so if I'm constantly thinking, "Leave me alone," I want to go on with my practice, quote unquote, it's going to be miserable for me and miserable for everyone I'm in contact with. So that he started to contemplate that what the different kinds of viveka or seclusion that the Buddha talked about, but kaya viveka, which means physical seclusion, is only one level of that kind of solitude. And the Buddha talked about other levels of that, particularly citta viveka, which is the internal seclusion or seeking that kind of retreat within oneself. And this was such a powerful insight or guiding influence for Ajahn Sumedho that when we were given the forest in West Sussex, after a couple of years in London, there were a chance encounter, also in Hampstead, obviously a hotbed for interesting encounters, a chance encounter on Hampstead Heath with a young man who happened to own a forest and was looking for some people to look after it. And there were these forest monks, you know, stuck in London looking for a forest to go and live in. When they moved down there, the name that Ajahn Sumedho chose for the monastery was Chitta Viveka. Using that term as a name for the monastery to underscore the significance he saw in that, and the importance of that, you know, you're a new religion in a fresh territory, and the people, many people are interested, and there needs to be that readiness to engage, to be accessible, to allow like that kind of contact to happen on the external level, and there's going to be a lot of building that has to happen. There has to be a lot of negotiating with governments, with legal bodies. There has going to be a lot of friction, maybe, you know, criticism from established groups and religions, and it's all going to be there. What do you expect? You know, it's not a Buddhist country. There's going to be all kinds of testing external conditions, and so the impact it made on him was like, don't look for peace in the externals, but let the externals be what they need to be to take care of the establishment and training and running of the community, but to seek peace on the internal level, to seek that peacefulness, that seclusion internally. And this kind of shift of emphasis was something that was, you know, in a way embodied in this vision of the Arctic that he had. So a couple of years to fast forward, as they say, fast forward to 2001 at Spirit Rock, and during the time he was Ajahn Sumedho was leading a retreat there, he used this same experience as an illustration of this principle, and talked about this vision that he had and the importance of establishing the Chitta Viveka, the internal seclusion, that quality of finding the attribute of peace regardless of circumstance. Because, you know, even today, and even when things are much more well established, there's still, you know, very, very strong sense within the Buddhist world of, you know, to really practice, capital P, you know, you have to be alone, you have to have silence, you have to have the right diet, you have to have, you know, this sort of hermetically sealed, perfect environment so that you can practice properly. And that everything's, all the conditions have got to be right. And that if you can't, if it's not quiet enough, or if it's not, or the diet isn't right, or the teacher's not right, or the, you know, the cushion's not right, or whatever, then you can't practice. Or you've got to be with people, you've got to engage with things. If there's people on the retreat, you know, or around who are talking, or if you have responsibilities, then you can't really practice, capital P. And so he tends to emphasize that this kind of domain when he's sort of teaching over here in particular, because it's such a strong sort of ethic within the people who've been practicing Vipassana meditation for a long time, that there's this a kind of assumption that, you know, special conditions are needed in order to really practice. So anyway, he was using this as an illustration, and then one of the people on the retreat perked his ears up and caught that the reference to the Arctic, and And so, being someone who likes the outdoor life and likes to go into the wild, and also being a man of some financial resources, he dropped round a day or two later to see Ajahn Sumedho after the meal time and said, Ajahn Sumedho, if there was an offer, if someone was able to invite you to actually go and visit the Arctic one day, would you be open to that kind of invitation? I said, well, of course. I said, well, I would like to invite you to the Arctic. Would you like to come? I said, of course. And as luck would have it, I was in the room at the time and got swept up in the little swirl of Arctic enthusiasm, and also I too had not in terms of meditation vision or nothing the same sort of symbolic quality as Rumpo or had really made that much of it myself, but I would every so often I would find I have these powerful dreams of being in the Arctic lands, oftentimes if I haven't got enough bedding. I suspect it was more prosaic causes that I'm freezing, and so my mind conjures up a nice sort of white wasteland to match the chilliness of my feet. So to cut a long story short, then this friend Richard Smith did some research and found that one could make journeys to these islands in the far north of Norway, and so it was arranged, and he invited Ajahn Sumedho and another monk, Ajahn Yanaraka, myself, and then two other lay people came along from the Michigan area where Richard is from, and he set up this extraordinary journey, because it was something that he wanted to offer to Ajahn Sumedho as a way of sort of actualizing that vision of being able to indeed go into that environment and to enter into that in sort of in an external way. And so there was a sense of pilgrimage, or wanting to make the journey in a way that matched that intention of a meditative exploration, so that we felt it would be better to go by boat rather than sort of fly straight in. And so Richard arranged this boat journey, which happened. There's a company that has a ferry that goes all the way up the Norwegian coastline, so it had a 4-day boat ride from the south of Norway and up through many different little ports, and passing through many fjords and islands and beautiful, incredibly beautiful landscape. And so there was like this gentle approach that we made to these islands in the far north. And funnily enough, as we were traveling along, we met a young Norwegian man on the boat, and he came up to us actually when we were ashore at one point, and he said, "Excuse me, can I ask you where you're from?" And he said, "Well, we're come from a monastery in England." He said, "But our community originates in Thailand." He said, "Oh, I was just in Thailand. Did you ever hear of a place called Wat Pa Nana Chat?" And so with great delight, I said, "Oh yeah, this is the international monastery. This is the monk who actually founded the place in 1975. And this is Ajahn Sumedho." So his face was a real picture. His jaw practically dropped off. And he told us there's a saying in Norway that if you travel by boat or away slower than that, then your soul travels with you. If you travel faster than a boat can travel, then you leave your soul behind. So that seemed to match the spirit of the way we were journeying. So the main purpose of the journey was to as Lumpo put it later on, it was a celebration of the silence, the inner peacefulness, inner solitude, spaciousness, and that it was like a pilgrimage to that, into that silence was really the aim of it. And it was quite beautiful how many other aspects of the journey kind of matched that. A kind of leaving behind of the world of sort of diversity and complexity and multiplicity and entering into this realm of great simplicity. It was springtime when we set off, and quite sort of fertile and green and lush in England and the southern part of Norway. And as we journeyed northwards on the boat, and then we came further and further into the Arctic landscape, so that the number of trees on the shoreline would get less and less, and the amount of snow was on the mountains beside the sea were getting increasing, and the shoreline was getting more and more kind of rugged and rocky. And so there was this a clear sense. And then, you know, then after a certain time there were no more leaves on the trees that we saw, and then by the time we got to the far north it was still, you know, way before spring. And so there was this a kind of clear entering into this realm of austerity or away from the realm of diversity. And then finally when we arrived on Svalbard, the islands are so far north, there are no trees there at all. At least the only trees there are like just 6 inches tall. And the only greenery that we saw there was patches of moss. And so the islands are very much like, as I would find like the best way to describe it, is like being in a black and white photograph. Everything is sort of black and white and shades of grey, covered in snow at the season. Also, the further north that we went, the longer the days were, until finally after we crossed the Arctic Circle, there was really, it was just twilight. By the time we got to midnight, it was just twilight, and it never really got dark. And then when we got to the islands themselves, to Svalbard, up at the 78th parallel, there was really no night at all. So 2 in the morning was indistinguishable from 2 in the afternoon. And it was very overcast, so you couldn't even see where the sun was. So it was just this ambient, continuous quality of light. So that it was very much like entering a timeless world. You know, we actually started to use the phrase, you know, the so-called night, or so-called tomorrow. It was just, there was no real distinction. It seemed like it kind of started to reflect back how, well, we have these little machines that we carry around called watches or clocks, and they kind of, the numbers change, the little metal bits sort of whirl around, but, you know, what's that got to do with anything? It's just, here is, you know, it's the same time. It's always the same time. Also, on the boat journey up, the sea was extraordinarily calm. The coast is, there's literally thousands and thousands of islands and reefs. So the sea is extraordinarily still. So about 80% of the time you couldn't actually feel any movement in the boat at all. It was a very large, 400 foot long ship. And there was not even the gentlest rocking motion. It was so that the experience was one of sitting absolutely still, and then these beautiful landscapes are sort of flowing past you. So that, like, you are this sort of observer in, you know, in this spacious capsule, and then the world is just these beautiful images just flowing by you. And Richard compared it to like one of those old theatres where they would have a kind of the backdrop, so the kind of scenery would be kind of on a spool, maybe someone winding the spool, so that people are kind of sitting in a car on the stage as the scenery is rolled past them. And so it felt like that sometimes. There was this kind of strange stillness that even the boat journey embodied, so that there was this different threads were appearing, were kind of part of the whole journey that kept pointing towards this qualities of internal stillness and spaciousness and so on. When we got to the island, then we met with the guides, and it was just between seasons, the end of winter, beginning of spring, so that Richard had been trying for months and months and months to arrange what we were going to do and where we could go on the island. And our contact person, Constance, kept saying, "It all depends on the weather." So no matter how hard Richard tried to arrange things, Constance always replied, "It all depends on the weather." That became our motto. Even sort of to the day before, we were actually going to set out onto the kind of backcountry. Still, all very much depended on the weather. But the brief that we gave to the guides as to choose where they would take us to was that what we would like is to find some place each day where there's silence, stillness, and spaciousness. And this was not the usual brief that they had. It's like, "I want to go see the walruses," or "Can we go see the penguins?" "There are no penguins." He says, "You wouldn't believe the number of times people ask about, you know, why are there no penguins on Svalbard?" You have to go a long way to see penguins. So this was a kind of a unique trip for them to arrange. But they were right on the ball, and they responded very well and found these beautiful places to take us to each day. And we travel by in these sleds pulled along by snowmobiles. And so we would set out each day. Again, so the whole quality of time is very elastic, so that nothing runs on a very strict schedule there. So when you say 10, it's, we would say meet at 10 in the morning, it would be 10-ish, a large I. Because, you know, the whole realm of time is kind of so arbitrary. Because it's daylight the whole time. And so the temperature doesn't really change between night and day either. So that you find these kind of all your familiar senses of orientation are being scrambled. So they take us out probably take an hour, a couple of hours of journeying through the various valleys and routes through the back country. And they would find these areas where other people weren't traveling, and there were no other people around. And we would just find a place to stop. And then, spread out a bit and just to sit and meditate for that, the afternoon. And it was also added spice to the whole thing was that, as I mentioned a few times before we went, that the humans are not at the top of the food chain on Svalbard. There's 5,000 polar bears and only 1,000 people. So you're not allowed to travel outside of the town, the small town, without an armed guard or without a heavy caliber weapon to protect yourself from polar bears. So that wherever we stopped, the guides would have to sort of patrol the area, and where we sat, they'd have to be sort of within sight of people in case some polar bears came by looking for lunch. So in the tradition, the forest monastic tradition of going to live where the tigers are, so to deliberately going into to the burning grounds if you're afraid of ghosts, that's like it's very much in the spirit of that. Because, you know, even though there's a guy with a gun still, you know, they're not allowed to fire. I mean, they really didn't want to harm any of the creatures. And so you basically, and it's very strictly forbidden to fire on a polar bear unless it's actually attacking. And they move over short distances faster than a racehorse. So that if a bear is attacking, you have 2 or 3 seconds to play with. So that, even though you might have a guard there, there's still a high element of risk around. If that gets your attention. But it was very wonderful to be able to offer that opportunity for Lumpur and to Ajahn Sumedho and to the rest of us, because it really, after the a day or so, Richard was saying to me, do you think this is like what Ajahn Sumedho was sort of seeing in his vision? I think, well, it seems pretty, I've heard him tell that story a lot of times, it seems pretty close, because because of the fact there's no trees at all. It's completely a barren landscape apart from the mosses and lichens on the rocks. When there was the air was still, when there was no wind, then the environment was completely silent. Also with the snow muffling even the ambient sound of voices, it's extraordinarily quiet. And so when we were all sat still, there was just no sound. You know, occasionally you hear the chirrup of a snow bunting, or a goose, or such like passing by, but fundamentally it was this extraordinary, palpable silence. It was like being in a huge silent chamber. And these vast Arctic valleys, very, very broad, level valleys covered in snow and distant mountains, and so forth. So quite extraordinarily beautiful. And there was, you could see and feel, and really, it really entered the heart. It kind of manifested in an external form, very, very clearly. And vividly, palpably, this quality of the internal qualities of peacefulness, of stillness, spaciousness, silence, and it really was like a celebration of those qualities. It was, of course, you know, the chattering mind can still do its thing, but it was very, very striking how the external environment. Being so simple and so plain, so open, it really supported the quietening of the mind. See, the thinking mind seemed so ridiculous and completely out of place, sort of didn't belong in that realm. But it was very, very striking how quickly the mind would just quieten down, and when it would start to sort of move or pick something up, how rather like if any of the people who live locally have been to Montgomery Woods, then you kind of come out on the pathway down into the grove of the great redwoods, this is silence that one walks into, this kind of sense of the presence of the great trees, and you feel like you're walking into this into silence. Peaceful chamber, and you want to sort of drop your voice and be quiet and still, because sort of being busy and chatty and bustling around just doesn't belong in that place. So similarly, the thinking mind was sort of and then that kind of the degree to which those sort of bubbling thoughts just did not belong was really, really striking. Yeah, as the time went by, then it was also impressive how strong the conditioning we have around, you know, time and such like qualities. Because well, one thing that really hit me was particularly on the first day that we were out, and it was the temperature was not that cold. It was only about 0 Celsius. It had been like minus 20 a week or two before, but because it was all ice and snow and sort of that kind of wintry scene, all my perceptions are winter, short days. Oh, look at the time, it's 3:30. It'll get dark soon, we should be getting back. You know, don't want to get marooned out here, you know, back in the back, you know, way out in the back country. You know, better be thinking about packing up and going. But of course, it's not going to get dark till August. You know, it's not even going to get cold, because the light is the same, you know, day and night, so that it just doesn't, the temperature doesn't even drop at night time. So that that whole sense of like waiting for the end of the day to come, or that you feel like there's a sort of waiting, that kind of habit that we have of waiting for the next thing to happen, or waiting for the day to end, or it's just, there's so many ways that just those habits were not being supported, and it was really reflecting right back at you. Yeah, what is time? What is time, really? When you're in a place where time just does not apply. I mean, it's, you know, we talk about it in terms of, you know, Dhamma teachings and, oh yeah, the Akaliko Dhamma, the timeless reality. But, you know, the day and night are real. But then suddenly you're in this place where, well, there isn't a day or a night. It's just the same timeless time. One of the things that, in a way, really entering into that realm and that insight is helpful for, and something that Ajahn Sumedho talked about quite a lot while we were there, was when he had just been in India for 6 months. It was quite a contrast, travelling in India for 6 months, and then he got back to England for two or three weeks, and then he was off on his trip to the far north. But he'd been staying in Benares for a couple of months, and as most of you probably know, Benares is a kind of has a very special place in the Hindu mythology, and is considered to be very, very meritorious. If you die in Benares and are burnt, you know, beside the river Ganges, and the ashes are put in the Ganges, then this guarantees a rebirth in heaven. So that Benares has been a place to come and die for many, many, many centuries, thousands of years. So there's very strong contemplations of death there, and Ajahn Sumedho was living in this place right by the river near the Burning Ghats. And so he was contemplating death a great deal, and he had this very powerful insight while he was there that really, and he kept saying, you know, it sounds stupid when you say it, but you know, you can't really say it any other way, but the other than the insight is that there isn't any death. That really, death does not really exist. It appears to. But really, there is no death, and that realization was very much tied to a kind of a wholehearted devotion to the here and now. That there's this recognition that really all there is this moment, and in this moment, death does not apply. As soon as you create time, then death has a meaning. You know, birth and death come into being, but here and now, in the moment, there is no death. And this might sound kind of a bit hokey or sort of meaningless or sort of woolly philosophy, but it's also a major key to Dhamma practice for us, because you can see how when we start to believe our thoughts or our plans, or we buy into that the patterns of past or future, then there's a me, there's this being that was born, that's now living, that will die. There's this real thing that I'm aiming towards, or this real thing that happened to me in the past, or that I did, or there is this whole set of structures, you know, my plans, or my projects, or my family, or my business, or my responsibilities, or my achievements. And in a way, this is like the kind of the realm of multiplicity and complexity. But when we really open the heart to this other dimension of our being, which is right here now, the timeless present, then when the attention is really wholeheartedly given to this moment, then those other elements sort of fall away, or at least they're seen as partial truths. Just as just seeing like a time when the sun doesn't rise or set, then what does the word time mean? So what this is pointing to in terms of Dhamma practice is, when we see the mind lurching after a train of thought or making a plan or caught up with a doubt, a question or a passion, a fear, then when we look at it closely, we see, oh, this is all related to time and to self. Like, what will I do? How was it? Or should I have done this? Or maybe I'll do that? Or what if he does this? Or should I say that? What if this happens or that happens? And we can see this is all just creation. This is all just fabrication around the present. And when we bring it right down to this moment, there's a feeling. Maybe a pleasant feeling of a delicious taste, or a neutral feeling of an idea, or maybe a painful feeling of a longing or a regret or an irritation or a doubt. But when we bring the attention right to this very moment, it's just this. It's just a feeling. It's just a question. It's just a pain, or just a question. And when we open the heart to it in its simplicity, it's just that much. It's no big thing. It's just this feeling. It's not complicated at all. It's like the Arctic landscape. It's all very, very simple. We might not be able to explain it, or we might say, "Yeah, but I've got real issues I have to work out here. I've got debts to pay. I've got people who I'm responsible to. I've got to worry about this. If I don't worry about it, who will?" Well, nobody. Does it have to be worried about? And that sometimes the kind of conditioned mind, the self-based, time-based habits can be screaming and begging, demanding to be attended to and believed in. But when we refuse to be intimidated by that, then we bring the attention back to, well, what's actually right here now? What is this? It's a thought, it's a feeling, it's an emotion. It's not that much. It's just this little thing. It's just this pattern. Nothing to get excited about, nothing to get frightened of, nothing to get annoyed with. nothing that's unbearable. It's just this much. Doesn't, and when we really open to it and look, nothing of it really intrudes upon the heart. The natural peace of the heart is always here, forming the environment for every pattern of perception, every thought or mood. It's always here, that peacefulness, that silence is here in behind, you know, every sound. Underneath the frogs and the crickets, there's a silence. And it's not as though that the, you know, the frogs and the crickets and the noises of our thinking mind are some kind of pollution. But what we find is that when we can really appreciate the silence, when we really can hear, attend to that fundamental silence and stillness, then we can we can enjoy the patterns that the, you know, the frogs and the crickets and even our kind of rages and irritations and fears and doubts make. It doesn't interrupt. It doesn't corrupt or intrude upon that basic purity. There's the ease of heart that underlies it, so we can appreciate the patterns, but not without being pulled around or deluded or confused, excited or depressed by the patterns that form. These are some reflections. This little journey that I was very blessed to be able to be a part of. I felt very glad and amazed, really, at the whole sort of unfolding of it. It was a very, you know, wonderful and extraordinary opportunity, and just to be able to be so close to Ajahn Sumedho and such a harmonious and fine group of people. And yeah, it was also a little sort of a strange treat that probably many of you have been around for a few days also know, but to our amazement, we found that of the 1,000 people living on Svalbard, 40 of them were Thai people, mostly from Phetchabun, out in from this little town in rural Thailand. So that even at the end of the world, there were kind of familiar faces, delighted to, he knew what monks were, and utterly delighted to see us and meet us. And I think it's the probably the northernmost offering of alms food to be made in the history of planet Earth, at least in this particular Buddha age.